Kunjabi Har, Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Gopi Janavalhaba Giri Varadhari. Jaya Gopi Janavalhaba Giri Varadhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Ajaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Gopi Janavalhaba Giri Varadhari. Jaya Gopi Janavalhaba Giri Varadhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming and thanks for staying for this part of the program. Of course, if you stay for this part of the program, you get the benefit of the fans, which reduce the humidity and the number of flies pecking at you. So this is the best place to be right now. Of the people who are here for the first time, I'm wondering how many of you are here at a Hare Krishna temple for the first time? Okay, well, welcome. Where are you coming from? Gainesville, okay, right down the road. Well, congratulations. It does take a little bit of both courage and audacity to come to a Hare Krishna temple for the first time. So we hope we don't disappoint you too much. At least there'll be good food at the end if you're patient enough to stick it out that long. On Sundays, we typically read from the Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. And the Bhagavad Gita is the basics of Hare Krishna philosophy, the ABCs, so to speak. It's a summary study of the Vedas. The Vedas and the Vedic scriptures are the scriptures that are typically associated with Hinduism, although they're not really associated with Hinduism. Hinduism, or what we think of as Hinduism, is really a modern word that doesn't appear anywhere in the Vedic scriptures and is actually fairly recent in the history of humanity. And for the people who are kind of old hats here, why do we need to listen to the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita again? We've heard it so many times. We want to hear the more advanced teachings of Krishna and the pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan and so on and so forth. And to that, I'm reminded of two quotes, actually, from some famous, well, one famous Westerner and one famous Easterner. There was a guy during the Renaissance named Leonardo da Vinci, who was an artist and a scientist and an inventor and an engineer. And he said, success in life comes from relentless pursuit of the basics. And so we always return to the Bhagavad Gita. And then I'm also reminded of a quote from a famous Easterner, a guy named Bruce Lee, who's a famous martial artist, and he said, I fear not the man who has practiced 10,000 punches. He said, I fear the man who has practiced one punch 10,000 times. And so those of you who come to my karate classes on Mondays and Wednesdays know that we do the same thing every time. So we always return back to the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita, which I said is a summary study of the Vedas. The Vedas consist of many parts. There are the Vedas and there are the Vedangas, which are scriptures in support of the Vedic scriptures. So there's the Vedas, the four Vedas proper. There are the Upanishads. There are the Itihasas, which are histories, like material histories. There are the Puranas, which are like epic mythological histories. Not that by saying myth, I'm ascribing any untruth to them. It's just they deal with times and spaces really beyond our human cognition. That's what I mean by myths. And then there are the epics, which in Indian history are taken mostly to be the Ramayana, which are the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra, and the Mahabharata, which is the story of the Kauravas and the Pandavas. And the Mahabharata is often taken to be the longest epic poem known to humanity. It's nearly 200,000 verses. And the Bhagavad Gita, this book right here, is one chapter in the Mahabharata. And so, but it contains the essence of all Vedic philosophy. And so we're just going to speak a little bit about that tonight. There are five topics, as we may recall, in the Bhagavad Gita. The five topics that are spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita are Ishvara, which means God or the controller. There's the Jiva, which is the living entity. Hopefully I'll remember them all here. I wrote five topics of the Bhagavad Gita on my notes here, but I didn't write down what they were. No. There's karma, which are the activities of the material, of the living entity within the material world. Karma, it's a word we're all familiar with. It's become quite commonplace in the modern culture to speak of karma. There's prakriti, which is the material energy itself. And then there's kala, which is time. And time is the umbrella under which the activities of the living entity take place within the material world. So this is all contained here within the Bhagavad Gita. And as is customary, I'm going to read, well, as is actually not customary, I'm going to read a few verses. Typically we read one verse in the purport, but I've picked out a passage. This is Bhagavad Gita 7.4 through 7.6. You may be familiar with these verses. Incidentally, we're also studying these verses in my middle school physical and health education classes over at the Bhaktivedanta Academy. So these are fresh in my mind. I'll read the Sanskrit and the translation of verse 4 and 5. And the Sanskrit, the translation, and the purport for verse 6. So verse 4 says, Bhumir aponalovayu kam mano buddhir evacha ahankara itiya me bina prakriti ashtada. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. All these together, altogether these eight constitute my separated material energy. So here Krishna is speaking about the topic of prakriti, material energy. And in the next verse he says, Aparyam itastvanyam prakritim vidi meparam jiva bhutam mahabaho yayedam daryate jagat. Besides these, O mighty armed Arjuna. Arjuna is the protagonist of the Bhagavad Gita. He's sort of the hero of the story. Besides these, O mighty armed Arjuna, there is another superior energy of mine which comprises the living entities who are exploiting the resources of this material inferior nature. So here Krishna is speaking very briefly about one of the other topics of the Bhagavad Gita, the jiva, the living entity within the material world. And then finally, Etad yonini bhutani sarvan ityupadaraya aham kritsnasya jagataha prabhava pralayas tata. All created beings have their source in these two natures. Of all that is material and all that is spiritual in the world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the dissolution. So here Krishna is speaking about a third topic in the Bhagavad Gita, the Ishvara, the controller, or what is usually translated in English in the modern world as God. And I'll speak more about that in a moment. But first, I'd like to read the purport, or the explanation of this verse. Everything that exists is a product of matter and spirit. Spirit is the basic field of creation, and matter is created by spirit. Spirit is not created at a certain stage of material development. Rather, this material world is manifested only on the basis of spiritual energy. This material body is developed because spirit is present within matter. A child grows gradually to boyhood and then to manhood because that superior energy, spirit soul, is present. Similarly, the entire cosmic manifestation of the gigantic universe is developed because of the presence of the super soul, Vishnu. Therefore, spirit and matter, which combine to manifest this gigantic universal form, are originally two energies of the Lord. and consequently the Lord is the original cause of everything. A fragmental part and parcel of the Lord, namely the living entity, may be the cause of a big skyscraper or a big factory or even a big city, but he cannot be the cause of a big universe. The cause of the big universe is the big soul or the super soul. And Krishna, the supreme, is the cause of both the big and small souls. Therefore, he is the original cause of all causes. This is confirmed in the Katha Upanishad 2.2.13, Nityo Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam. Om Angyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Shtapitanyena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Sva Padantikam. Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Ebacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. All right, I've learned not to speak extemporaneously here at New Raman Reti Dham. So first of all, the five topics of the Bhagavad Gita, we are explicitly addressing three of them here. Prakriti, the nature of the material world. Jiva, the living entity within the material world. And Ishvara, the source of both of these things. So first, regarding prakriti, or material nature, Krishna describes material energy as consisting of eight primary elements: earth, air, water, fire, and ether. This is a little bit different than the modern scientific conception of the material world, which has 100-something elements. They're always discovering new elements, some of which only exist for a few seconds after they smash things together in a gigantic machine and see what comes out of it. But Krishna describes the material world in terms of eight energies. And it's not as if one of these is wrong and the other one of these is right. There are different ways of categorizing everything in the world based on what we want to get out of it. The material world is classified according to the Bhagavad Gita in terms of five gross material elements. These are the types of elements that we can perceive directly. So earth is everything which is solid, right? Water is everything that is liquid. So these are the different types of substances or kinds of substances that we see in the world. There's air. Air is a gas, right? Fire is heat. We can sense heat directly. We measure heat in terms of temperature, and so on and so forth. And there's also what Prabhupada translates as ether. This is the word kam or akash. Prabhupada translated as ether. Ether was a word that was very, let's say, was in common usage when Prabhupada was a younger man in his teens and 20s when he went to school. It's kind of fallen out of scientific usage these days. But ether refers to space, or the volume in which everything takes place. So there's space in this room, and within the space of this room, there is also gas, heat, water, and earth. Yeah, thank you. I heard somebody think it. And so these are the gross material elements. We can perceive and measure these things directly. Krishna also speaks of three subtle material elements, and these are the mind, the intelligence, and the false ego. So we can't see these things directly, but we understand their existence by their action in the world. So the function of the mind is to accept and reject things for our own pleasure, basically. The mind thinks, oh, it's so hot, let me find the air conditioning. And then in the wintertime, of course, we don't really have wintertime here in Florida, but in the wintertime, oh, it's so cold, let me go sit by the fire. Or, I like the salty prasadam, but I don't like the sweet prasadam. Or, I like this song, but I don't like that song. Or, oh, this is a pretty dress, but oh, that's a hideous dress. These are all functions of the mind. The mind is to accept and reject things based on our, you know, moment-to-moment desires for sense gratification, to please our senses. And I'll come back to that point in a moment, if I don't belabor this point for too long. The intelligence is situated even more subtle than the mind. The intelligence tells us what is right and what is wrong. So I may like the sweet prasadam, I may like the salty prasadam, but the intelligence knows what I'm supposed to eat in order to maintain my health. So everybody loves to eat ice cream, but ice cream is not really that healthy for everybody, right? So this is the function of the intelligence. The intelligence knows what is to be done and what is not to be done. So everybody likes to drive very fast on the freeways in Florida. If you don't believe me, just go drive on the freeway in Florida, and you will see everybody's driving very fast. But the intelligence knows if I drive too fast, I may get into an accident. And even if I don't get into an accident, I may get into trouble with the police. So the intelligence knows what is to be done and what is not to be done. And so we understand the intelligence by its action. Who is an intelligent person in the world? The ahankara, the third of these subtle material elements, is the living entities, the jivas, misidentification as being a product of all of these other material elements. And so we often think, oh, my mind is driving me crazy. How many of you have ever had this experience? Oh, my mind is driving me crazy. Those of you whose hands are not raised right now are lying. Our mind is constantly driving us crazy in one way or another. But this is a misidentification. We think this mind is me. But no, it's a material element. We are associating with the mind as a material elephant in different modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. It's easier to understand this if we identify with the earth in our body. We don't think, I've got a sore back right now from digging in the garden, right? But I don't, and I think, oh, my back is driving me crazy, right? This is a misidentification of me, the living entity within this body, with the body itself. It's not my back. The elements that are making up the muscles in my back, which have air, earth, water, fire, and ether, right? They don't belong to me. I didn't go out and buy them at a store, right? I was just born into this situation, and over time it's developed, and due to misuse of my intelligence, I've got a sore back right now. Due to misuse of my intelligence as well as the slow advancement of old age, which advances more slowly or more quickly depending on how advanced our old age is to begin with. So when we're young, our old age advances very slowly, and we think, I'm going to be young forever. I remember when I was a brahmachari living in Vienna, there was a group of devotees that went to India on their yearly pilgrimage, and one of them brought back a great gift to the entire ashram, and that was the great gift of hepatitis A. And so I received this gift with an open yet unwilling heart, and I turned bright yellow for a couple months. Luckily, there was an Ayurvedic doctor, I forgot his name, but he was a very famous Ayurvedic doctor from Vrindavan who was traveling around Europe at the time, and he came and he gave some free consultations to the brahmacharis in the temple, and I went and saw him, and I told him, I've gotten sick before, but it's never taken me this long to heal. And he said, yes, when you are 25, you are not your body, but by the time you turn 30, you will realize that you are your body. So we start thinking we are our body. So even time is relative. So when we're young, time is advancing very slowly for us in a year. Like, I know students come back to school in the middle of August and they think, oh my goodness, a whole another school year. But for those of us like me who've done nothing but be a student his entire life, one school year is like a blink of an eye, because it's a substantially smaller portion of my entire life within this body. So what to speak of when we become 50, 60, 70, and 80, time starts to pass much faster. That was a little bit of a digression here. So these are the eight material elements. The last one is the ahankara, which is the false identification of the jiva, the living entity, with the body itself. And what makes up the body? The body is made up of senses, right? Seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and so forth. And these are each associated with one of these material elements. The sense of the nose and the sense perception of smelling is associated with the earth, right? And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am the original smell of the earth, right? So when we can escape the city life for a minute, and one of the great opulences of this community here, Alachua, is that we live in a legitimately rural area, yeah? And so there's deer everywhere, and the air is very pure in the morning, especially the mist is settled on everything. And there's some last stands of North American hardwood forests right here within 10 minutes drive of us. And we can go and we can smell this. And this smell is a function of earth. And that pure smell of the earth is a representation of Krishna in the material world. It's the same with water. So the sense perception that is associated with water is taste and the action of the tongue, right? And then there's air, which is associated with touch, right? Air is made out of molecules, and it provides a sensation of touch, you know. And this is the skin. So there's the sense organ, there's the sense object, and then there's the material element that facilitates the sense perception. So air, touch, and the skin are all related to each other as part of the material body in the material world. Fire is associated with sight, and it gives form to everything. Without light, which is heat or fire, we would not be able to see anything, right? How many of you have ever tried to see in the dark? Yeah, it's hard. It's very difficult to find a place where there's actually no darkness, but I remember when I was teaching geology at the University of Florida, we used to take students to this place about 20 minutes north of here called the Bat Cave. And it wasn't called the Bat Cave because there were a lot of bats in there. It was called the Bat Cave because it reminded people of Batman. But there are some rooms in this cave where there is legitimately no light. And so we go in there and you can't see. And it doesn't matter how long you stay in there. Your eyes will never adjust. You'll never be able to see anything because there's no light. So light, which is an aspect of fire, gives rise to form, which is a sense perception. And that is facilitated by our eyes, which is a sense. And then finally, there's ether or space. And space is the material element in which we can perceive sound, right? Which is hearing. And so this goes from gross, the earth, smell, to subtle, hearing, and ether. And this is all activated by the soul within the material body. Without the soul in the material body, none of this can go on. There is no sense perception. And that's the difference between, and this is a debatable question, but that's the difference between a human being and a rock, for example. You know, the rock has no, as far as we can tell, has no sense perception because it's not imbued with the living entity. The living entity has not activated it. Now, there may be bacteria living on the rock. There may be a soul within a giant mountain whose action we only see over the span of many millions or hundreds of millions of years. But the activation of the senses through material energy is provided not by material energy itself, but by the living entity present in the material world. And this was a key feature of Srila Prabhupada's teachings to the Westerners. Prabhupada preached very strongly against this idea that life comes from matter. Life did not arise from a mature combination of material ingredients. There was a cosmic soup some 4 billion years ago on this planet, and when the cosmic soup went off enough, it started to bubble into life. This is not the conclusion of the Vedas. The conclusion of the Vedas is that the living entity enters into the material world and all of this action occurs. And that's true for the very first prokaryotic cells that arose out of that cosmic soup, and it's true also for the gigantic manifestation of the universe. The universe manifested when Krishna cast its glance over it and imbued the entire cosmos with living entities. So the Bhagavad Gita says that the living entity in the material world is sarva gata. There are living entities everywhere. And this is the active principle of the material energy. There is a singular living entity that is in and is this earth, Gaia. Not here, probably listening at home. Or Bhumi, here somewhere, I thought I saw her. Anyway, we're all named after these people. There is a singular living entity that is in the sun, Surya Narayan, right? and so on and so forth. There are demigods in all of the planets. So Shahi is in Saturn. I know a lot of people who are going through their Saturn phase of astrology right now, which is considered materially inauspicious because it's imbued with a lot of austerity. But that is spiritually auspicious. If our material life becomes difficult, this is an opportunity for us to turn our eyes to Krishna and embrace the fact that this material world is not really a nice place. There's some nice aspects to it, no doubt, but it's not really a nice place. So in the first verse that I read, we learned a little bit about Prakriti, which is just how material energy is constructed. What is it made out of? And in the second verse, we learn that the material energy becomes activated when a soul enters into it. And this is true for even smaller than the smallest single-celled living entity. The mitochondria that are in our cells, those of you who have taken a high school biology class will know that mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell. But in an animal, every single cell has mitochondria in it, which are transforming the material ingredients to provide energy to the living entity. But every single one of those mitochondria has its own DNA. It's its own living entity. So even on a level smaller than our cells, we see that there are living entities being active and metabolizing material energy to produce energy that the living entity can use. And Prabhupada translated the second verse that I read. He said the living entity is here exploiting material energy. We are here in this world trying to enjoy our association with material energy. We want to smell something nice, and we don't want to smell anything not nice, right? We want to taste something nice, and we don't want to taste anything not nice. We want the temperature to be just exactly perfect, not too hot, not too cold. I remember my grandmother used to stand at the top of the stairs in her house, and she used to order her husband around, turn the air conditioning down, and he'd turn it down to whatever temperature, and then she'd go back and sit in her chair and read her Reader's Digest. This was before computers. She'd read her Reader's Digest, and then 5 minutes later, she'd get up and she'd yell at her husband, go turn the air conditioning back up, because she got too cold and too hot, too cold. And so she's trying to enjoy. I don't mean to pick on my grandmother. She most likely can't hear me right now. But this is, we're all trying to enjoy the material energy. Sometimes we hear a very sweet sound, a bird singing. When I go for a japa walks in the morning, really the night, I really enjoy the sounds of the bullfrogs croaking. Especially I live a little bit out of town on a dirt road, and it gets pretty loud, right? It becomes kind of like cacophonous, all of the insects and amphibians and reptiles who come awake at night. But then I'll walk by somebody's house and their guard dog will start barking. Why are you chanting Hare Krishna here? And this is a sound I don't like. And I get mad, or I get scared. And I go, maybe I should walk somewhere else. And so this is exploitation of the material energy. We are trying to enjoy here in the material world. And there's some enjoyment, but the enjoyment always has a cost, right? The enjoyment always has a cost. The more we use our senses for enjoyment, the duller they become, right? When we're young, we go to the rock concerts and we love the bass. I used to love to stand next to the speaker. But now I noticed I was on the Friday before the festival weekend, last weekend, we were watching some videos of Srila Prabhupada in our classroom. The memories of Srila Prabhupada, the following Srila Prabhupada video series. And there's these videos of Srila Prabhupada without any sound, and then there are the voiceovers of the people who were there talking about what was happening. And I had plugged this into an amplifier that somebody had donated to us, and the kids are all complaining. There's this really high-pitched ringing coming out of the amplifier, and I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't hear anything. They're like, no, and I'm like, you guys are crazy. They just want to go do something else. They're trying to get me to shut it off. And they're like, no, every time somebody speaks, there's this high-pitched, like, ringing, and I can't hear it because my senses have become dulled due to excessive exploitation of material energy. And so many examples of this. You know, if we try to enjoy some of our senses too much, we get disease. All right. If we eat too much, we get a stomach ache. You know, if we engage in other types of illicit activities, all kinds of bad things can happen. So there's a moment of enjoyment, but it always comes with some sort of suffering. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that what at first is like nectar, but in the end is like poison, is suffering in the mode of ignorance. We are just ignorant of what the true cost of our enjoyment in the world is. And then he also says what in the beginning is like poison, but in the end is like nectar, is happiness in the mode of goodness. And so true happiness always comes at the cost of austerity. And if we're willing to have the austerity up front, then we get a much bigger payoff than the immediate enjoyment. So a great example of this is, you know, especially in the United States here, you know, this country, and this is not a political statement, this is just a statement of fact. We are, as a country, as a nation, we are hopelessly in debt right now, right? Trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And mostly this is consumer debt. This is people buying things that they can't afford, right? But there are companies usually also looking to exploit material nature in the form of other living entities who will lend you the money that you can go buy what you want immediately. I tried to do this just yesterday. I wanted to get a new mandolin, right? I'm like, well, I don't have any cash. Let's see if the Guitar Center will lend me the money for the mandolin. And they would have at like 35% interest. And I'm like, nah, forget it. That's happiness in the mode of ignorance. I want something immediately, but in the end, I'm going to wind up paying 35% more than I needed to. In the same analogy, happiness in the mode of goodness is just to save your money. Practice the austerity of not, you know, going and buying that extra half gallon of ice cream or taking that extra road trip or whatever it is that we spend money on without thinking, and save it up for what you need. This is spiritual life. This is an analogy for spiritual life. Spiritual life is that we try to reduce the material enjoyment we're engaged in for the sake of disentangling ourselves from this existence. And this is where the third verse that I read comes into play, where Krishna says both the material ingredients of this world and the living entity that activates them, I am the source and the dissolution of both of them. And so Krishna is establishing himself as the supreme controller, the Ishvara. Ishvara, this word is usually translated as God in the Western world. I find that, you know, if you say the word God to the wrong person, they'll immediately start freaking out, like, no, we don't believe in God, or whatever. In the world, we see there is a gradual progression towards atheism in our world. And so I just want to take a minute and, in my notes here, I wrote, what is the purpose of the Hare Krishna movement? The purpose of the Hare Krishna movement is to establish an understanding of God as an irrevocable guiding fact in our society, right? We've gone away from understanding that there is a supreme controller and that we are subservient to this. In the grand scheme of things, we are no match for material nature. Death and old age and disease are coming for us all, right? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, janma, mrityu, jara, vyadhi, dukkha, dosha, anudarshanam. Birth, death, old age, and disease. These are the real problems of existence, right? These are the real problems, and these are inescapable. You know, I've said this before, no baby is born laughing, right? They're all screaming, like, ah, put me back, what's going on here? Everybody's screaming at the time of birth. You know, the husband's passing out, the mother, it's just a mess, right? And then it's gradually things subside. I mean, and then for the next few years, this is just, you know, bodily fluids coming out at both ends and needing to clean it up. And then we hit puberty, right? And then it's like, I didn't ask to be born, right? This is the common phrase from every teenager. No, you did not ask to be born, but yet here you are. You know, why is that? It's inescapable. This is a problem for the living entity. Nobody wants these things. Then we get sick, we get old. Everybody experiences this, and this is not enjoyable. There's a brief window in our lives where our intelligence has developed enough so we know how to enjoy material energy, and our senses are still strong enough that we can do it. But this is just a few fleeting years, you know, and gradually our intelligence may remain, but our senses are weak, right? And we can't, you know, hike that extra mile. Or we can't eat that sugar anymore, or whatever it is. And so we, as a fact, we have to accept that we are subservient to material nature. And the intelligent person, the person who has risen above the platform of their mind and is starting to question with their intelligence, why is this happening to me? Right? Why is this happening to me? What is the path out of this? This person begins to awaken their understanding of what God actually is. So what is God? What is this word God? Srila Prabhupada writes that the idea of God and the idea of the Supreme Person are not exactly the same. God is a job title. It's a position that Krishna holds. Krishna is responsible for the administration of all of the material and spiritual universes. From him, all of the material and spiritual universes are emanating, and when it's time to wrap it all up, they will dissolve back into his body. And he's responsible for the administration of all of it. And he does this by appointing his empowered demigods, right? I mentioned earlier Bhumi, or Gaia, the earth. Gaia is a singular living entity who is giving sustenance to so many innumerable living entities. There are 8 billion, approximately 9 billion humans on this planet. But within your colon, there is a soup can full of bacteria. And that's another 8, 9, 10 billion living entities in every one of the billions of humans. And what to speak of trees, you know, algae in the sea, you know. There's innumerable living entities. And Bhumi, Gaia, the earth, is giving sustenance to all of them as an administrator of Krishna's universe. The same with the sun, right? Without the sun, there's no plants. Without the plants, there's nothing else living here, right? Even if somebody has a purely carnivorous diet, and of course we do not recommend this at all, but this is a fad in the modern world, the caveman diet, the paleo diet or whatever. Well, the cavemen were just eating, you know, bison or whatever, so we're just going to eat bison. But those bison are subsisting on plants. So the sun is giving life to all of us, which is why the sun holds a special place in our pantheon. But these are all demigods. These are all empowered administrators of Krishna's state. But Krishna is ultimately responsible in his role as God for all of it. But there's another aspect of Krishna, which is Bhagavan, which is the supreme personality of the Godhead. The Srimad Bhagavatam explains that God, or the supreme absolute truth, that truth which is not affected by any of the permutations and changes I mentioned of material nature, has three aspects. One is an impersonal aspect. This is the all-pervading eternality of existence. So even though this material universe is temporary, it began at a point in time and will ultimately dissolve at another point of time. That is happening eternally. And even the modern scientists accept this on some level. There's a big bang, and that'll be followed by a big crunch, and then the big crunch will be followed by another big bang, and that'll be followed by another big crunch, and this just goes on and on and on eternally. So there is an eternal aspect of existence, which is called Brahman. This is the eternal feature of God. There's also a feature of God which is conscious, right? Which has knowledge. The chit aspect of Krishna. This is awareness. And the living entities in the material world are imbued with a small portion of this awareness, this knowledge, based on the bodies that they've acquired. And the bodies that we acquire are functions of our karma, of our activities in the material world. So if we use the body that we've acquired wisely, we will achieve a body in our next lives that have more facility for awareness, the chit feature. Krishna, God, is aware of everything all the time, which is inconceivable, right? This is called achintya. He's inconceivable. How could that be? There's Krishna in my heart, and he is aware of every single thing that's going on in my body. And there's a Krishna in your heart that is aware of every single thing that's going on in your body. And this is true for every body that is existing. Krishna is in there, and he's fully aware of everything that's going on simultaneously. And therefore, he is able to relate to every individual living entity individually. And this is the feature of Krishna that is called Bhagavan, the personality of Godhead. And this is a bit of a philosophical argument. We see that in the material world, there are personalities, right? Some personalities are kind of shy and reticent, and they sort of have like a dry or lacking sense of humor, right? Other personalities are boisterous and gregarious and extroverted and cracking jokes all the time and clowning around. Some personalities are very intelligent and logical. Other personalities are very intuitive. But where do all these personalities come from? The source of anything must contain the qualities that it is manifesting, right? Within the seed of a gigantic oak tree is the entire code for how this oak tree is going to develop and interact with its environment and grow and reproduce and all of that self. So within the seed of the absolute truth, our personalities are manifest because the seed of our existence also contains a personality, and that is Krishna, that is Bhagavan, the supreme personality of Godhead. And he is here waiting for us to relate to him. And so just to conclude some thoughts here, we can escape the advance of material existence by turning our eyes away from the exploitation of material energy and towards entering into a relationship with the supreme personality of Godhead, Krishna. Krishna is waiting for us just to turn around. There was a Swami here a couple of years ago who was giving class to our kids, and he said, you know, when we first enter the material world, it was Romapad Swami, for those keeping track at home. He said, when we first enter the material world, we have a very high position. Our first status in the material world is as a controller of an entire universe. And Lord, that's Lord Brahma, for those of you who follow the Hindu pantheon or who are knowledgeable about the Hindu pantheon. And Lord Brahma is a very intelligent living entity. Lord Brahma knows that he's, in the material world, and he doesn't really belong here, right? He was born in darkness, we read in the Bhagavatam. He's looking around him, what's going on here? Where is everybody? Where is everything? What am I doing here? And he looked around for a long time. Finally, he heard Krishna, and he realized that he was not the supreme controller, that there's somebody beyond me. And Krishna spoke to him the original four verses of the Bhagavatam, in which he said, it is I only who is existing before this material world, and it is I only into which this material world will dissolve. And yet Lord Brahma continued with his mission here in the material world. And Romapad Swami, who is visiting us, he asked, why is this the case? And this is because as soon as we come in contact with material energy, we become lost and entangled. And that is the situation of the material, of the living entity in the material world. We are lost and we are entangled. And the more we try to find out who we are by exploiting material energy, the more lost and the more entangled we get. So the purpose of the Hare Krishna movement is first and foremost to reestablish in human society the idea that we are not the supreme controllers, which we all observe directly. Right? There are always things going on in our lives that are outside of our control. You know, the municipal government decides to start trimming trees right when everybody wants to show up for Guru Puja. And everybody's just sitting here in traffic for 45 minutes, missing the Guru Puja, or late for school, or whatever it is. Beyond our control. So many things beyond our control. Mark Twain, the famous American satirist and humorist, said once, there are only two things that are certain in life, death and taxes. Right? And nobody wants to pay taxes, right? Nobody wants to die. These things are beyond our control. And so we are not the controller. We are also not the enjoyer. We have some level of enjoyment in our lives, but it's limited and it deteriorates over time. And so the first purpose of the Hare Krishna movement is to establish the idea that we are neither the controller nor the enjoyer. We are what Srila Prabhupada described in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita as the co-operator. We are the co-operator. We are cooperating with Krishna. And then the second purpose, there are many purposes, but I'm just listing two primary ones right now. The second purpose is to provide a pathway to the living entity to get out of this being lost and being entangled. And that pathway is called yoga, right? The word yoga in Sanskrit, yog, is related to the English word yoke. Not like the yolk of an egg, but the yoke that you would attach to oxen if they were pulling a cart. It's to join together. The Latin word religion, or the English word religion, comes from the Latin religios, which means to relink. This is yoga. Yoga means to relink our consciousness with the original supreme consciousness, Krishna consciousness. And so this is a great ocean of knowledge and wisdom that we can dive into. Obviously impossible to get into all of it in the 45 minutes that we have for our Sunday feast class. But in the last few minutes here, I'll just see if there are any questions or comments from the audience. Yes, Prabhu. I think we have a microphone available. But if you want to just belt it out for the purpose of time, I can repeat it into the microphone. Go ahead. Yes.
When Krishna spoke to Lord Brahma after he was born, and he said tapas,
yes,
those were the first word,
yeah,
which means, and I think Vishnu said, nothing happens without tapasya.
Yeah.
But also Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that no one comes to me without unalloyed devotional service, without bhakti.
Yeah.
That you can't come to me by austerity, tapasya, you can't come to me by money or knowledge, or only devotional service can you come to Krishna. But at the same time, nothing happens without tapasya.
Yeah.
So is bhakti dependent on tapasya? Bhakti is independent of anything. So you don't. Do you need tapasya for bhakti? Is bhakti not as strong as tapasya? Is bhakti stronger than tapasya?
This is a great and very deep question. So he's asking about tapasya. Tapasya means austerity. This is one of the 10 yamas and niyamas of Ashtanga yoga practice, is to practice austerity. Austerity means to give up immediate enjoyment for the sake of a higher cause. And he's asking if bhakti is dependent on austerity. Do we need to practice austerities in order to awaken bhakti in our heart? Oh, my Boston accent just slipped out there. The short answer to that question is no. Bhakti is not dependent on tapasya. Bhakti is only dependent on the mercy of the devotees. Bhakti isn't even dependent on the mercy of Krishna. This is explained by Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur in his Madhurya Kadambini. So for a more detailed answer to your question, I highly recommend this book to you and to all of you. This is the Madhurya Kadambini by Srila Vishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, who is late 18th century Vaishnav scholar. But Prabhupada also writes in the Bhagavad Gita that from the beginning of karma yoga, which is working, you know, for Krishna, to the end of bhakti yoga, which is really relishing the eternal pastimes of Krishna, is a very long way to go. And so while bhakti is not dependent on tapasya, tapasya is a practice of bhakti. And so our practice of bhakti includes tapasya. But we should not think that Krishna is some sort of machine that I put in my necessary tapasya, I put in, you know, my vegetarian diet, I put in my sobriety, I put in my offering obeisances 3 times a day. We should not think that just by mechanically engaging in these activities, Krishna will somehow become obliged to us. This is the philosophy of the Mimamsavad, the Karmakanda portions of the Vedas, that if there is a God, he is obliged to give us the results of our karma. This is rejected by the Vedantists. So we are followers of the Vedanta. And within the Vedanta, there are two schools. There's the Advaita Vedanta, which accepts monism as the absolute truth. And there's the Bhagavad Vedanta, which accepts Krishna as the absolute truth. But in all schools of Vedanta, this idea that if there is a God, he is obliged to fulfill the results of our karma is rejected. So tapasya is a practice of bhakti, but we should not think that just by engaging in tapasya, Krishna will be forced to reveal himself to us.
And just a real quick second question.
Okay, since you have the microphone, I cannot refuse.
So you know, you were talking about the three aspects of God, you know, like the energy, the super soul, and the Bhagavan.
Yeah.
Is that hierarchy, like superiority? You know, is the super soul higher than the Brahma? Because there is no super soul in the spiritual world, but yet the Brahma Yoti is above the material world. And if the super soul is only here in the material world, how could the super soul be higher?
Well, all three of these aspects are pervading the material. So the Brahma Jyoti is also here. You just can't perceive it. So this is likened to the sun, From a distance, we perceive the sunshine, right? And we perceive the form of the sun a little bit, although I do not recommend looking directly at the sun. But, you know, in the morning, you can kind of see it. In the evening, you can kind of see it. During an eclipse, you can put on some special glasses and look at it. Not that we're recommending that either. But the sunshine is all-pervading in this universe. And then the form of the sun is localized in time and space. It's about 8.5 minutes away from us and, you know, 150 million kilometers, according to the modern astronomical version. And then what is harder to see is the personality of the sun god, Sorna Orion, who is the living entity that is operating this whole big machine. So, but here's the thing. I said that the sun is 8.5 minutes away from us, 7, depending on where in our orbit we are, it changes a little bit here and there. Let's say 7 minutes away from us. So in this room right now, there's sunlight. If you go outside, there's sunlight, and you can find a wave of this sunlight or particle of this sunlight, and you can travel, you can follow it back. You can take a journey with it all the way back to the body, to the form of the sun. But at no point will you find a place where the beam of sunlight ends and the actual form of the sun begins. They're the same thing. And then the sun itself is the body of this demigod, Sorna Orion. So the point is that these three features of Krishna, Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, they're the same thing. The difference is our experience of relating to it. So somebody who relates only to the Brahma-jyoti, and Prabhupada explained, and he used the example of Socrates, who that just by philosophical speculation, one can come to the conclusion that there is a Brahma-jyoti. And he said that Socrates came to this conclusion just with his philosophical prowess, and therefore when he was told to drink this hemlock for corrupting the youth, he was just like, all right, bottoms up, cheers, Haribo, away we go. But if that is the only realization of Krishna that you have, your destiny will be to come back down to this material world, because it's the nature of the material entity is to be active. And within the Brahma-jyoti, there's no activity. So this is God realization. Brahman realization is God realization. But the experience of the realized person is a limited feature of it. It's the same with it's the same with Paramatma. The mystic yogis, when I was in college, the first time I was in college, I dropped out of college twice before successfully completing. let me just take a moment and say, one of Krishna's attractive features is that Krishna is the most renounced living entity. And normally when we think of attractive features, we think of beauty or fame or wealth or power like this. But when I was in college, I had a picture of this yogi sitting in a kopin, just sitting in a loincloth on a glacier in the middle of the Himalayas. And I thought this was so cool, how renounced this yogi was, you know. And so by that type of mystic meditation, one can realize the localized Paramatma in everybody's heart. But that's not the same experience of realizing, you know, we sing the song Jaya Radha Madhava, which Prabhupada says this is a complete picture of Vrindavan. So realizing the Paramatma in everybody's heart is a form of God realization, but it's not the same thing as realizing Krishna's sporting pastimes on the banks of the Yamuna, or, you know, his dancing in the moonlight with the gopis. And so it's the experience of the devotee that makes the difference between these forms of God realization, but they are all forms of God realization. And now I'm afraid you have to pass the microphone to somebody else for one more question. Anyone else? All right, well, now it's time for everybody's part of the Sunday feast, the feast. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.